This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Fake news, it's a phrase that's been thrown around a lot lately, whether it's a blatant lie or a manipulation of the truth. There's no question that we are susceptible to these alternative facts. But why is that? My next guest says it's because of a trick the brain uses to process information. Can anything be done? Well, a new study out this week suggests there may be a way to inoculate yourself against this, an immunity to fake news. Sandra van der Linden is assistant professor of social psychology at Cambridge University. And Dr. van der Linden, welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to be on the show, Ira.
Thank you. Also joining us is Anthony Lazarowitz, senior researcher and director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Lazarowitz.
Hi, Ira. Great to be with you again.
You're welcome. Let me begin with you, Sandra. First, what is the brain doing that makes us susceptible to believing what we now call fake news?
Well, what I think is happening is that often we're heuristically processing information. And by that, I mean that we're often in autopilot. And so when we look at information on the internet, when we notice that a million people have shared a certain video or clip or news article, that sort of signals to us that it must be important. If everyone's looking at it, if everyone's reading it, then it must be worth sharing. And what people tend to do is just kind of share and reshare that information, and that increases the transmission of fake news and trying to sort of nudge people out of the state of autopilot and taking back control over the steering wheel. That's what we sort of tried to look at with this idea of inoculation.
Mm-hmm. Does putting figures in you know, the news, the fake news, give it any more content? Does that make it sound more reasonable?
Well, figures can be sticky. And so perhaps that's what the attraction is in terms of how people remember information. If you have an abstract paragraph about a topic, it might be hard for people to remember that, but figures tend to be sticky, and so they're easy to remember and also misremember.
Mm. Dr. Lazarowitz, so this study you did shows that there's a way to vaccinate ourselves against this, though, right?
That's right. That's what we seem to see, is that if you basically, it's very similar to the concept of inoculation or vaccines in the physical body. So we know that if you give the human immune system a short dose, a weakened dose of an infectious agent, let's say the flu, your body learns how to protect itself against that virus when it encounters it back out in the wild. In a similar, very analogous way, what we're finding, and this is actually built on decades worth of prior research, that if you give people a short exposure to a weakened version of the disinformation, it actually then protects their mind, essentially, from the effect of that disinformation.
And so if you then sort of give me an idea of what that would look like or sound like.
Sure. Well, in the course of this particular study, we were looking at a really important basic social fact, which is the fact of the scientific consensus that human-caused global warming is happening. We've seen that only about 15% of Americans actually understand that there is, in fact, this scientific consensus. And moreover, lots of prior research has shown that when you simply tell people that 97% of climate scientists have reached this conclusion, most people will change their own estimate of that consensus quite dramatically, like 20 percentage points. However, we also know that there's been a long-standing and pretty effective disinformation campaign for years trying to undercut and undermine that basic fact. And so what we did in this study is, first of all, tried to identify what were some of the most effective disinformation memes, if I can use that word, out there. And one in particular is one that's gone by the name of the Oregon Petition. It's basically this petition that supposedly was signed by 31,000 scientists, all claiming that human-caused global warming isn't happening. Well, to the uninformed, that actually sounds like, you know, what scientific consensus? 31,000 scientists signed this thing? That doesn't sound like a consensus. Until you learn that the signatories included noted Nobel laureates such as Ginger Spice of the Spice Girls, Mickey Mouse, I believe Adolf Hitler signed it, and, of course, the late, great Charles Darwin. So, and then further analyses have found that almost none of the signatories actually have a background in atmospheric science. But it doesn't matter, because the opponents have used that claim to basically try to discredit the findings of the scientific community. Mm-hmm. And I'll kick it over to Sandra to help explain exactly how the experiment worked.
Yeah, Sandra, please.
So basically, we had five different conditions, and we started with, in one group, we just presented people with the facts. So the fact that most scientists agree on human-caused climate change and that it's happening. Then in another condition, we just showed people the global warming, the Oregon petition, so the disinformation in this context. And in another condition, we paired the two together to see what happens when people are confronted with two different stories, one credible, the other not credible, if you will. And so what we find, if we just present people with the facts, then basically people shift their opinions in a direction consistent with the conclusions of climate science. When you just show people the false information, it has a negative effect on their perceptions of science and the scientific consensus. When you pair them together, the misinformation actually neutralizes, it cancels out the positive effect that the basic facts have on people. And so it's really that really tells us it's hard to communicate the scientific consensus in a way to the general public because of the nature of misinformation and the damaging influence that it has on communicating basic facts. And so in the last two conditions, we thought, well, is it then possible to try to inoculate people against misinformation to protect the effect, the positive effect that communicating the scientific consensus has on people? And then we had two conditions, sort of a brief inoculation, where essentially we warn people that there's politically motivated actors who use misleading tactics to try to influence people. And then in the more detailed inoculation, we debunked the Oregon Global Warming Petition specifically. And so we took a bit, just as Tony explained with the vaccine metaphor, we used a bit of the misinformation and pre-exposed people to that information, and then we debunked it with specific facts, mm-hmm. such as the idea that there's fraudulent signatories on the petition, the Spice Girls, Charles Darwin, et cetera, that only 1% of the actual signatories that have a background in science have anything to do with climate science. And so we armed people with specific facts that they could then use to build resistance against future exposures. And mm-hmm. in fact, what we find when we then actually expose people to the full dose or the actual global warming Oregon petition, people are more resistant to misinformation. Not to say that they were fully immune, but they were more resistant and less influenced by misinformation than before.
Let me go to the phones because we have an interesting phone call from a high school teacher in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Renee. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you so much for taking my call. First of all, I love your show, which I forgot to mention when you took my call a couple months ago, and
thank you.
I apologize for that. As I said, I'm a high school science teacher, so and in a rural district at that. So how can I take this study and help my students be better consumers of news, especially science news, because they're constantly plugged into their, you know, to their phones, and like you said, they see that 400 million people have shared something, and so they're like, oh, this is totally true. You know, I can't seem to make that connection of just because it's on the internet.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that it's real.
All right.
You know, how can I use that in my class?
All right. Let me ask Cassandra. Anthony, any suggestions for her?
I'll take a quick stab at that. So first of all, this is what we did in this study is look specifically at could we inoculate against a specific false claim, and that's about the scientific consensus. But this same phenomenon, of course, plays out, if you will, upstream in the communication process when you think about sources. And so what I would strongly recommend to her is that you teach some of the basic skills of critical media literacy. As in, if you help students really take a moment and think about, where is this information coming from? Have I ever heard of this source before? Is it, you know, a credible source? Is it Scientific American? Is it, Science Friday, the preeminent source we should all look to trust? Or is it something you've absolutely never heard of before? That's a really important cue that can help you disentangle truth from fiction.
Mm-hmm. The sources, as you say, sources have always been very, very important. Of course, if someone is already... I'm staying with your inoculation metaphor. If you've already been infected by an opinion, if you have a definite opinion one way or the other, the inoculation is not going to help you already, is it? Or does it?
Well, that's an interesting question because essentially that's how the original metaphor was articulated. But in thinking about this, I think we're extending that metaphor with the current research in the sense that depending on the medical context, if somebody is already infected with a particular virus, then administering a vaccine can certainly make things worse. In some cases, this would be analogous to, let's say, a backfire effect if we're trying to inform people. But in other contexts, it can still offer incremental protection against future infections. And in fact, in the experiment, what we find is that the inoculation actually worked fairly well across the board for different political groups. For people with differing prior beliefs in the issue. This is not to say that it, you know, just as vaccines don't offer full immunization to everyone, and sometimes you need to go to the doctor multiple times in order to get the full vaccine, I would say that, of course, it doesn't work for everyone. But generally, we found that certainly it doesn't backfire with people who are predisposed to maybe have differing views on the issue. Of course, there are certain people that are never going to change their mind, and the vaccine probably will not be helpful to them. But certainly our research suggests that there is, especially among people who are doubtful, who are on the fence about the issue, who have not made up their mind just yet, that it can, in fact, be helpful, even if they've already been exposed to misinformation in the past.
I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Sandra van der Linden, Assistant Professor of Social Psychology at Cambridge University. Anthony Lizarowitz, Senior Researcher and Director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. Gentlemen, thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Coming up, an algorithm that will remove terrorist images from the web, but should we use it? And, well, if it exists, how come no one is using it on social media yet, really? You know, Facebook, Google, it's not there. Maybe, you know, maybe it will. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in the early 2000s, the growing internet had a big problem. Child pornography. Millions of pornographic images flooded the World Wide Web, and the U.S. government, which has laws against child pornography, was powerless, virtually powerless to stop it. Every time an image was taken down, it would appear online again someplace else. That is until 2008, when Dr. Hani Farid, a computer scientist at Dartmouth College, partnered with Microsoft to develop a piece of technology that prevents these images from being repeatedly posted on the internet, blocking around 10 million each year. Now, Dr. Farid wants to set his algorithm loose on another dark corner of the internet, terrorist messaging. Images and videos used to incite acts of terrorism populate social media and other online platforms, and they have inspired attacks in Paris and Brussels and Orlando. But despite a global call to action to crack down on terrorist messages online, the algorithm has been rebuffed by the tech industry. Why? With me to discuss it is my guest, Dr. Hani Farid, professor of computer science at Dartmouth College and senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. Welcome, Dr. Farid.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Why was the issue of online child pornography so difficult to tackle?
Yeah, you'd think it would be a relatively easy thing to tackle given how horrible this content is. The main reason why it was difficult to content is there was concern about how you could build technology that would efficiently and accurately remove content without catching in its net innocent material. And that's a real concern, of course, online when you're dealing with billions and billions of upload. And so it was really a question of accuracy. From the tech companies, there was also a concern about liability. Are we opening ourselves up to liability if we are now actively looking for this? And if we don't, you know, if there's some remains on and some takes off, and are we going to become liable? But it was primarily a technology issue. And so the breakthrough we had in 2008 2009 was to develop a technology that did not actually take the human out of the loop. It actually left the human in the loop to make that very hard determination of what qualifies as child pornography and what does not. And then it would let the technology loose looking for that content that had previously been determined to very clearly, unambiguously be child pornography. And that's why it's actually been so successful in the worldwide deployment.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the photo DNA, the tool you and Microsoft built to combat child pornography online. How does it do that?
Yeah, that's right. We're talking about photo-DNA. And the basic idea is that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC, is home to millions and millions of known child pornography. There is no question of the age of the children in the images. There is no question that the content is sexually explicit. And what we do is we reach into those images digitally and we extract a signature. And that signature has two very important properties. One is that it's distinct. Two images that are different don't have the same signature. And the signature is stable over the lifetime of the image. As that image makes its way around the internet and either intentionally or unintentionally is modified, that signature stays the same, very similar to the human DNA, right? Our DNA is unique, and as we age, as we change our clothes, as we cut our hair, our DNA stays the same. And that's what allows us now to sit at the pipe of a Facebook, a Twitter, any Dropbox, and scan every image coming in and ask, is this simply in the database or not? And by the way, we do very similar things for viruses and for spam and for malware. We extract unique signatures from those media, and we make sure that that content does not get uploaded. So it really piggybacked on an existing infrastructure, and we just simply expanded that out to the child pornography space.
So they Twitter, Facebook, all those social media, they cooperated with you on this?
Well, it depends how you define cooperate. So I think early on, there was resistance and there was skepticism. Microsoft and myself here at Dartmouth developed the technology. We deployed it at Microsoft. We showed that it would work. We showed that it was accurate. We showed that it didn't make mistakes. And we showed that it was effective. And then Facebook came on board, and then Twitter came on board, and then slowly the dominoes started falling. But there was skepticism early on, some of it justified, some of it, in my opinion, not justified. But now the technology has been proven, it's reliable, it's effective, and it doesn't actually make mistakes. It's incredibly accurate because we don't try to solve that very hard problem of asking a computer to distinguish in reality between child porn and not. That's still the job of the human that is really, in my opinion, uniquely qualified to do that. But then once it's done, we let the technology loose, and then it can be very effective in filtering this content online.
Well, how come you're able to, once you identify with the help of humans, how come you're able to pick it all up? Why is there not new photos coming online all the time?
And there are new photos coming online. It's a very good question. So we're able to stop the redistribution of content. But here's what you have to know about the distribution of this material is that people don't traffic in one or two images. They traffic in dozens or hundreds of them. So imagine somebody's uploading 100 images, and just one of them, just one we have previously seen, we will snag that entire upload. And then somebody can manually go in and review the new content. Let's determine that, in fact, it is child pornography. Add that to the database, and we grow. So we are vulnerable for a short amount of time when new content first arises. But as soon as that is caught, it can be added back into the database and then automatically detected. Now, ideally, we wouldn't do that. Ideally, we would have software that can determine it, but we don't have the technology. Take the most advanced machine learning, the most advanced computer vision and pattern recognition, and it does not operate at the internet scale at that accuracy. And so we are left with this type of technology, which, you know, has its benefits and its drawbacks, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, but you think you can take a tool like photo-DNA and use it to combat online terrorist messaging?
Right. So at the heart of the photo-DNA work is it doesn't know anything about child pornography. It's simply reaching into a digital file and extracting this distinct signature. And so what we have done in collaboration with the Counter-Extremism Project based in New York is to take that core technology that was developed for images and extend it to video and audio, which is the dominant source in the counter-extremism space. But conceptually, it's exactly the same idea. Organizations like the Counter-Extremism Project, in collaboration with industry, scholars, folks from free speech groups, decide on what qualifies and what does not qualify as extremist speech. You extract these signatures from the content, and you stop the redistribution of that material. So the framework is exactly the same as what we have done in child pornography, which is exactly the same as what we've done in the spam and malware and virus. We are just now expanding the technology, which had some real technical challenges to the video and the audio domain, but we've now tackled those and are ready for deployment.
But you've actually offered this technology to companies for free, but so far—
For free, in fact.
And they're not taking it. I mean, Google, Facebook— social media like that, and they're not taking it.
They are not.
And we actually asked Google and Facebook to come on and explain that, and we haven't heard back from them
yet. I'm not surprised.
Well, why are you not surprised?
Well, I think there's a reluctance to get into this space. I think that there are complex issues. I think it is politically loaded. I think they are nervous about the precedent it sets. My view is we can no longer pretend that the internet is not a place where terrorists are recruiting, radicalizing, and glorifying with real consequences. And I think the social media companies are nervous that if they go down this road, well, eventually they're going to have to go down another road. I don't really buy into that slippery slope argument. I genuinely believe that we have a real and immediate need. We have a real and immediate danger and a real and immediate problem that we have to address. I think we have the technology to address it. I think we can do it in a way that's thoughtful to all aspects of this problem. And I don't think we can solve all of the issues, but I think we can chip away at it. And I think we should do that. I think the time has come. I think if you talk to the families of San Bernardino and Orlando and Brussels and Paris, they are tired. They are tired of the people who are killing their family members, being radicalized online, and being given a free pass because we are claiming that the problem is too complex.
I misspoke before when I said we are waiting from Google. We're actually waiting here from Twitter and Facebook. But if I heard you correctly before, you said initially there was resistance to the original photo DNA, and it went away. Perhaps the initial resistance might go away here.
I think that's a good insight. I feel like the issues with the counter-extremism are playing out in a very similar path as the child pornography space. There's an initial, we can't do this, the technology doesn't exist. We develop the technology, it's like, oh, but there are legal issues, there are speech issues, and those go away. And I think what will happen over time is mounting pressure from governments, from the media, from the public will say, look, we don't want the free-for-all. We don't want people blowing each other up anymore. And the time will come where the internet companies are going to have to do this either on their own terms or it's going to start getting legislated. So I think the time will come. I don't know what the time frame is, of course, but the trajectory is moving very similar to the deployment of photo DNA. And I think we're sort of in stage two or three of that process.
Let me bring on another slightly different point of view. Jillian York is Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jillian, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
I imagine you've been listening to what we've been talking about. What is your reaction? Are you fearful that there might be some civil liberties here?
You know, I am. And I do think that great work has been done on the database, been working with NCMEC to identify child sexual abuse imagery. But my concern here is that terrorism is not the same thing. It's not the same scope. And so I think that while the database, while I understand how the database works, and I think that if we could, let's say, trust one entity to determine which images should go in there, then, you know, there may not be a problem. But for me, the question is, who is deciding what goes into this database? Who is defining extremism or terrorism? And if it's Silicon Valley companies, I think that we should be looking at their record of what they take down on their platforms and what they allow to stay up.
Hani, how do you react to that?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So I will tell you that back in the day when we were deploying this in child pornography, we heard similar concerns. There was concerns that, well, how do you define child pornography? How do you know somebody's not 18 years old, 18 and a half? How do you define sexually explicit? That sort of probably means different things to different people. And so even in the child pornography space, which you think would have this black and white definition, you do not. And so the way we dealt with this was to stay very clear and very far from the line. So the images that are in the database are 12 years and younger, prepubescent. There's no question of age. They are content that have clear sexual content. There's no question as to whether this is sexually explicit or not. And in the counterterrorism space, Jillian is absolutely right. There is content that can be debated as to whether it is extremism or terrorism related. But there is other content of people getting their heads cut off and then driven over by a Jeep, of explicit calls to violence, not subtle, not nuanced, not coded, but explicit calls. And we believe that in this worst of the worst content, there is very little ambiguity. And I think we should stay very far away from content where there is some question as to whether it is terrorism related or not, and start removing some of the worst content. I agree with Jillian. You don't want this into the hands of individual companies with inconsistent policy. I think this has to be in the hands of groups like the EFF, like technology companies, and like the CEP.
Let me, before we run out of time, Jillian, would you want to respond to that? What if the EFF got involved in it?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, honestly, that's the ideal route. If you're going to be dealing with the worst of the worst, and I know there will still be people who raise concerns around speech, but if what you're talking about is beheading videos and images, I think that what we have to be shifting the conversation to now is what that oversight looks like. Who has oversight, what kind of NGOs, and what kind of transparency, because these companies are notoriously opaque about their policies and their enforcement policies. I've personally been banned from Facebook for 24 hours for a mistake on their part, on the rules. And this sort of thing happens every day, and the project that I work on tracks that. So I think we'd want to make sure that we know how these companies are defining extremism and terrorism, how the project is, how, you know, how they're defining what goes in, and making sure that there is, you know, an appeals system as well for users to have a path of recourse if they've been wronged.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Hani Farid and Jillian York, we're talking about a new tool to crack down on terrorist messages, online terrorist messages. It seems like there is common ground here, Jillian, right? There's somewhere, some way?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm here to raise concerns. And I do think that, you know, anytime we talk about taking down content, we absolutely have to look at all of these different elements. And that's the part that I think has been missing from the public conversation on this. But, you know, I do you know, trust in the way that this particular database has been crafted and the explanation of how the images are identified.
Do you know if the social communities, I know I'm thinking Twitter or Facebook, are seeking to get involved, or are they just sitting back for a while, seeing how this plays out?
I don't have any real insight into that. You know, another question that I have about this, though, is can, you know, why couldn't a database like this be also used to give users more control over the kinds of things they want to keep out of their feeds?
Like fake
rather
news?
Rather than taking down the content. But perhaps.
Honey, could you use it for fake news?
Very good question. You could in theory. The technology we have is specifically designed for multimedia content, so images, video, and audio. There is a text version of all of this. I think the fake news is much more complex because it happens so fast and the content is so rapidly evolving. In the child pornography and the extremism space, the content is not changing on a daily basis. And so that static database or that slowly growing database is a little bit more effective. So I think that we are going to have to start tackling a lot of these issues. And I think we've raised three of them today, child pornography, extremism, and fake news, and more are to come. And I think we have to start being thoughtful and not reactive on how we do this and deploy technology in a way that is respective and thoughtful and careful so we don't make mistakes.
Let me get a quick call in from Carmel, California. Kate, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, you guys do wonderful work. Thank you so much for all your messages and your earlier message about girls in science. But my question or concern right now was, in hearing the discussion, it almost seemed to be pointing that, or the discussion seemed to be indicating that terrorism is only coming from abroad. And would these algorithms also be able to be used, applied effectively for the terrorism, domestic terrorism, such as racist and the attack in the church in South Carolina, you know, in our recent in history here, things of those sort, can we also apply those algorithms effectively for all the terrible things, even though, you know, the things that go on here?
All right, the question from Kate. Hani?
Sure. I think that's a really good question to ask. So the algorithms, of course, themselves are agnostic as to what they are removing. So that's a question of what do we decide is extremism speech? And that can be either domestic extremism or international extremism. And that's where the discussion, and those are hard discussions, and we should have them, and we should have them in an open and transparent way. And I think it comes down to a number of things. It comes down to the terms of service of the companies, and it comes down to legal issues that need to be resolved and thought of. But of course, the algorithms themselves are perfectly happy to filter whatever content we decide as a society and as an organization, we can take care of that.
Jillian?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's what concerns me, because we know that the decisions in these companies are made by a high-level team of mostly Harvard graduates, mostly white Americans. We know that that's who crafts the rules, and we know that these rules are sometimes enforced through, you know, kind of questionable labor practices and in a very haphazard way. You know, I've had friends have parody content about terrorists taken down. For example, a gay pride flag superimposed over the face of Hassan Nasrallah was censored from Facebook. And so, you know, I'm not willing to put the trust of online governance in the hands of corporations at the moment.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's an interesting conversation. We will, I'm sure, get back to in the future. Jillian York, Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Dr. Hani Farid, Professor of Computer Science at Dartmouth and Senior Advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to create high-powered microscopes and centrifuges out of paper and string for under a buck. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Can you hear that? Now, what do you think it is? Well, I'll give you a hint. Remember when you were a kid? Maybe you were a kid, you had a string you hold between your hands, you pull back and forth, and a little paper disc would spin between it, and it'd spin, stop, and go in opposite directions. Well, we have a young technologist who has taken that technology and actually made a centrifuge out of it for under a buck. He called it a paperfuge. You know, science labs can be pretty techy places. They have high-powered microscopes and centrifuges, lots of expensive machinery. But not every lab has access to these tools, either through a lack of funding or sometimes not even the bare minimum, like electricity, to power these devices. Well, my next guest takes these constraints as a challenge, and it's the guiding principle of his design philosophy. He breaks down the basics of these instruments to make them simpler and more affordable for everyone. And his latest invention, which I'm pulling on now, is a centrifuge that's made out of nothing more than a string and a disc of paper and some cheap little handles here. And he's here to share his ideas about designing on the frugal side and how that can spark innovation. Manu Prakash is an assistant professor of bioengineering at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I love this. You know, I had this as a toy as a kid. I don't remember the name of what it's called. Maybe you do, as a toy.
Yeah. In many cultures, it's either called a whirligig, run, button on a string.
It was a button on a string.
It's kind of surprising.
Yeah, that's what it was. But you took the disc, you made it into paper, and you were able to, because it's spinning so fast, make a really ultra-cheap centrifuge out of it.
Yeah, there are a couple steps in the process. We actually explored many different toys before we stumbled upon this idea. I actually started with yo-yos, and then a postdoc in the lab actually imaged the whirligigs. And one of the important distinctions here to think about in the notion of building these scientific instruments is the very first time we built it, it was spinning fast, but not as fast as we finally got it to by actually applying the traditional principles of engineering and just mechanics and dynamics to this problem. We realized this very old toy can actually reach limits of 125,000 RPMs.
Wow. And without no electricity required. It's just you can do serious science with it?
I think the philosophy of the lab is when you talked about constraints, to really ask what do we need to get done with the constraints in mind, and the tools need to adapt to that. So literally with the tool that you're spinning in your hand, we can separate out individual malaria parasites from blood in 10 to 15 minutes. We can separate blood from blood plasma in 90 seconds. You can pull out many different types of parasites. And effectively, you know, when you are one of those billion people that live with no electricity, no infrastructure, that piece of information is extremely valuable.
Mm. Now, I know that you're also a physicist and you study topics like the fluid dynamics of how starfish larvae eat. How do you get from that to creating these cute little devices?
I think the fundamental thread is curiosity. I personally don't see a difference. And I think one of the philosophies of making these tools is the focus is not the tools. The goal is to make people curious, and both by providing these tools, but then, of course, I use these tools and everybody in the lab uses these tools to explore the world around them. If you were to really think hard about it, the dynamics of what a starfish does in the way it churns and explores its environment, you can start writing down mathematical equations that have lots of similarities to how you would write down mathematical equations for this little spinning disc.
Our number 844-724-8255, if you want to talk about this. As wonderful as that little project is, there's something even more amazing that I have with me, and this is a very cheap little camera called the Foldoscope. The Foldscope, which is a paper camera that you hook up to your cell phone's camera and use that as a microscope. How did you get to that? That's terrific. We have pictures. We're putting up pictures and photos of this as I'm using him in the studio. But that's great.
Yeah, I think one way of thinking about that is think of it as a pencil for microscopy. So this is a tool that allows you to see the microscopic world with no other aid. So, of course, you can use it with a cell phone to capture the data, but you actually fundamentally don't need a cell phone. You can just watch it yourself. And the key aspect of this work is, you know, if you look at challenges around all the way from healthcare, biodiversity, environmental pollution, all the way to things like climate change, the origin of many of these problems lie at the microscopic scale. But then us as humans have absolutely no intuition of the microscopic scale. So one of the challenges that we posed in the lab was, how are we going to make that intuition available to everybody? So just like a pencil, you know, my wish is that people carry around microscopes in their pockets. And that was the origin of this idea.
How are you able to keep the costs down so low, to a buck or two, for these things?
So I think we start with the problem first, and then once we box ourselves in with these constraints, you really have to push hard on just, you know, what are the laws of physics that allow us to do this? And if you really work with these constraints in mind, so for example, the Foldscope is made out of paper because we exploit the complexity of origami and the precision that comes when you fold one fold after the other. That leads to the optical alignment that's necessary for a microscope. So I think I say this sometimes, that many of these solutions are right under our noses. It's just we have to look for them. We have to have that constraint in mind and the desire to make scientific tools more broadly available. So I would argue that almost anything that you think about has the capacity to be made such that it could be used by everybody.
Hey, one of the great innovations on this is that there is a very powerful lens on this piece of paper. And I'm trying to describe it to a radio audience. The paper has a couple of magnets on it, and you have matching magnets on your iPhone or your cell phone, and that hooks them, that aligns them to your lens on your cell phone. But then you have a very tiny lens, very powerful lens of your own that's about the size of a pinhead. How did you design that? How were you able to do that?
Yeah, so that goes back into the history of microscopes. It's quite interesting where the idea of the what we think of as compound microscopes with many, many, many lenses came first. And then a new idea originated, which are called simple microscopes, which are single-lens microscopes. And so we borrowed inspiration from that, but then spent a lot of time really optimizing that specific single lens to provide us the best possible resolution, to a point where, you know, we can image submicroscopic things, you know, below a micron. And the power lies in mathematics and physics, is to you just go back and ask, what does laws of physics allow me to do with very specific constraint, which is I'm only allowed two glass surfaces. So it's I think the answer, again, is, you know, living by the constraints.
And you're smart enough to figure that out.
I would argue that I think it's not just the I think it's not about being smart, but about being not giving up. You know, we've been building these instruments for the last 5 years, and every step of the way adding more and more features. And the joy really is in sharing this tool with other people and what people do with it. So as a community, which we've shared this tool with 50,000 people around the world, they literally blow my mind every day when I read the kinds of things that the community does around the world with simple tools like this, and at that same time, hacks that people will build on top of it. So to me, it's an ever-changing object, and the joy is really in seeing where we take these types of tools.
Mm-hmm. We had the vacuum cleaner inventor, James Dyson, was on the show a few years ago, and he said failures are interesting. I mean, you as an inventor must agree that the world is built on failures. We always think about the triumphs, but it's really the failures, one after the other, till you find the right solution.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And every failure has something to teach. When it works, there's not that much to teach.
Now let's go to the phones to Oakland, California, to Don. Hi, Don. Welcome.
Hey, Ira. Let me turn down this radio completely.
Good idea.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Truk District of Micronesia in the 60s, and I was a public health worker. One of our jobs was to test how many people had filariasis, which is a precursor to elephantiasis. So the Peace Corps gave us a wonderfully complex thing called the centrifuge. It was about a 7 or 8 inch piece of hard plastic with holes drilled in the middle. And they gave us some nylon string, told us to hammer a nail into a post, and we could figure out the rest. In the plastic were like six tiny slits where we could actually put these little tubes of blood samples that we collected at night from people. And we actually would cap these little things, slip them in the slots, and spin the homemade centrifuge. And believe it or not, we could actually separate the blood into the clear and the darker. And in that clear, we actually found samples of the microfilaria worm. So there's an example of a very simple application of the centrifuge process that actually worked.
That's great. Manu, you tried the paperfuge out in Madagascar. What did you learn from that trip?
Yeah, that's correct. And this is so wonderful to actually hear, because creativity is everywhere. And I think one of the aspects of some of these works is that we should just share many of these solutions, because these solutions are critically needed in the sets of challenges. So in Madagascar, we actually shared this with healthcare workers. We are very focused on malaria, but of course we have tried filariasis, that works. We've of course used this for anemia tests. Madagascar was fascinating because we actually took this tool to communities that are 6 hours, 12 hours away from any roads. And literally, the community health workers that work here, their eyes light up when they see solutions like this, because, you know, the harsh realities of the billion people that live about no infrastructure is that they need tools that they can literally own and modify and use on a daily basis, something that if it breaks can be fixed. So it's, I think to me, it's quite a gratifying experience. One part of it is working on these solutions, but the really important part is to sharing them with the right mm-hmm. set of people and transferring that knowledge, which is what we will continue doing. And one of the aspects of Madagascar is to do a much more detailed clinical work on this as well.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Manu Prakash, Assistant Professor of Bioengineering at Stanford University, and a little tinkerer and inventor. Maybe that's his day job. I'm not sure which is your day job and which is your night job. you also have a $5 chemistry kit that was based off of a music box. That sounds quite interesting. Tell us about
that. Yeah, now you can start seeing the connection with toys. I love toys.
We never outgrow
them. You know,
them.
Frankly, toys have a fascinating philosophical thing, which is they are whimsical for a reason, because they surprise us. And whenever there is a surprise, a scientist looks at that and says, aha, there is something really interesting happening. So I think one of the purposes in that project, which we're again now pushing in the context of diagnostics to diagnose, bringing molecular diagnosis to people using that little tinkering tape device, is the precision of musical notes that you hear on a music box is exactly what you need to really be able to control fluids in small volumes. And this is one of the reasons why some of the technologies that were designed to do diagnostics don't work out in the field, primarily because they require a lot of electronics and control to provide that precision, but a simple tinker tape also provides that. So you can see these connections where we borrow ideas from some of these phenomena that are right in front of us, but then apply them to pretty dramatically different settings.
Yeah, I'll give this out again later at the end of the show, but I want to give it out now. We have an education guide on our website if you want to make the paperfuge yourself at home, and that's sciencefriday.com/paperfuge, and you spell that paper, F-U-G-E. So we'll get back to that. Anything you're working on next? Yeah, what should we? You have a design that come a challenge coming up?
Yeah, yeah. I think with two students in the lab, we are now, we've been working for the last year in trying to understand. I mean, everybody heard about Zika and the challenges associated with it. Mosquitoes don't come with passports, so they go wherever they want. And ironically, we don't have many good measurement tools for detecting them, figuring out where they are. So there is a new project that we will be announcing short enough in the future where we utilize regular cell phones, traditional cell phones that people carry in their pocket, even the flip phones, the $10 phones, to detect mosquito species purely from their wing beat frequencies and sounds. So this is yet another way of engaging the community in actually tackling the problems that are affecting them directly.
I'm pulling my jaw back up again. It just dropped down. Wow. And it sounds so simple, you know?
Yeah, it is very simple, actually. You know, you've been sitting, of course, you've been bitten by a mosquito before. Remember that buzz in your ear? That buzz has enough information to tell you whether that species actually carries a deadly disease or not. And one of the things, if we can track these species, it becomes very important because then you can have policies, you can have control programs to reduce the influence of some of these species that are, quite harmful. And at that same time, it is a way to bring and pass the ownership of surveillance to the communities themselves because they are the ones that are out here in the field living with many of these deadly diseases.
Wow, you've blown me away for the weekend. This is great. A nice way, nice upbeat note to end this, Manoush. Thank you for...
I don't know. I would say that I am upbeat with what's happening now and how, evidence and facts are being questioned. But I would say maybe if there is any role for these tools to make people curious again, I would be pretty excited.
We're excited too. Manu Prakash, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Assistant Professor of Bioengineering at Stanford University. It's sciencefriday.com/paperfuge. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Great stuff on our website up there now. You can see some photos of me fooling around with that little microscope. All kinds of other interesting stuff and how to make these great devices at home. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.